And it's my pleasure to introduce Clarence S.
Thank you very much. And good morning, everyone. I am Clarence Snyder, and I live over here in St. Petersburg, and I am also a transplanted Yankee, having come from Ohio, where most of the drunks come from. And it certainly is a great pleasure being here, and I do want to thank the committee for asking Selma and myself to take part in this wonderful get-together. And believe me, from what I've seen so far, this is really going to be a goodie. This is going to be a dandy convention, and I'm certainly glad that I'm part of it. I'm certainly glad to see a few people here this morning after seeing them all running around last night all hours. I didn't think there'd be anyone up today. But then last night, watching this performance, and I was sitting out here and I was reading the placards and the signs around and reading the theme of this convention, how it works, I got the idea that's what I probably ought to talk about, how it works. I think this, that AA, there probably is a number of ways of quitting drinking. Some of them are not so well recommended and not so, perhaps so, lasting. But there are different ways. We have been forced to quit while we were locked up at times. People have taken pledges that lasted for a while. People have gone into different programs of recovery and have had various results with it. But that isn't what we're talking about in this convention here. We're talking about how it works in AA. And that's what I'd like to speak about. I think that while there may be many ways of quitting, unlike what I hear from some people in AA, I think there's only one way of doing it in AA. And we have a well-defined program in AA that lays it out on the line for us. I hear people say, well, everybody doesn't do this the same, and I'm sure of that because everybody doesn't stay sober here either. But I have found that if people follow the regulations that are set out in our program, they don't have any trouble with drinking, and they find out that drinking ceases to be a problem. People talk to me about a drinking problem. I have a hard time understanding what a drinking problem is. I never had any problem drinking, but I had an awful problem quitting, and a worse problem staying quit. And that's why I came here. And when I came to this fellowship, I might say it was not known as Alcoholics Anonymous at that time. It was known as the Oxford Movement. And we didn't have this well-defined program at that time. We didn't have this 12-step program. But the Oxford Movement, they had the makeup of the Oxford Movement, the alcoholics were way in the minority. The earth people governed this outfit, the civilians. And the Oxford Movement did a lot of good, and a lot of people learned a lot about how to live through the Oxford Movement. And those people were really dedicated, and they got to the place where they felt, and rightly so, that they could fix anybody, even rummies. But when they started working on rummies, they got into some problems they hadn't anticipated. But they had a limited success with them. The first people who came to our fellowship came in through the Oxford Movement. My sponsor and Bill and all the rest of these people did. But eventually it got to the place where the rummies needed a fellowship of their own. We found that a lot of the things we had to mix with as far as the civilians were concerned, they just didn't work too well. It watered down the effort somewhat, so eventually, we got this wonderful program which we are using now, AA. And it's made to order for alcoholics and their families. And this is what I am interested in, is our program. I'm not interested in any other. God help people, and Lord love them. If they can do anything any other way, that's their choice. If they come to AA, I think there's a way to do it, and I think there has to be certain requirements. In the first place, I think that there has to be a need for a change. And the next thing is, I think we must recognize this need as an individual, and we must want to change. There are a good many alcoholics that need a change, but they don't want to change. So obviously, this wouldn't be their cup of tea. I've met people in my drinking days and since who are really confirmed alcoholics, and they just as soon stay that way. They don't want to change. If they want this change, then I think that they have to accept the challenge and the opportunity that this fellowship offers. And if they do this, it must be all out. Alcoholics by nature are extremists, and we never do anything by halfway measures. An alcoholic, when he works hard, he plays hard, and when he gets drunk, he makes a career of it. And believe me, when he starts on a program of recovery, it better be in the same vein. Because if it isn't that way, he's not going to have too good a result. And by too good a result, I mean a certain quality. I look for a quality of life in this. Sobriety is the first thing we look for. That's what we come here. That's the key that opens the door. After we attain this sobriety, we find that this has to be maintained. And there's only one way of maintaining it as far as an alcoholic is concerned in a matter of quality, in my book, and that's through this fellowship, through this plan of ours, through a change in our life. Now, I have no quarrel with any other system, but this is what I prefer. And this is a simple thing as far as I'm concerned, and I need a simple program because I'm not smart enough to take anything else. And I try to keep my program very simple. Now, we are first of all helped in this area of coming into this fellowship and in this accepting this challenge and this opportunity, I think, by a power of example. This fellow, this Greek boy last night, was talking about the power of example. And I think this is very important because I think that when we are approached and visited by our sponsor and by other members of the group, and we are introduced to a group of people in AA, our first impression we receive from these people is very important to us. Most of us come in, we are probably skittish about it and we're suspicious and we wonder about these things. But when we meet these people, it's disarming. I know when I met the fellows who preceded me, the power example there was awfully important to me. I was in a hospital in Akron, Ohio, in City Hospital. My sponsor was Dr. Smith, and he had these men come up to visit me. They were all chaps who were older than I was in years, and they all had had fearful alcoholic careers. And they came in there and visited me and told me the stories of their lives. And I looked at these fellas, and they impressed me. I could see they had the same thing I had. We call it identifying. I certainly identified with these fellas. The only difference is most of them had been at it longer than I had because they were older. But they were all 24-carat rummies. And they told me what had happened to them through their drinking careers. And here I looked at those men, a good many of them just sober a few weeks and a few months, but they had something about them. They had a quality about them that I wanted. And I was heartened by these fellas. I was pretty much of a whipped dog when I came in here. And these fellas gave me my first hope that there was a chance for me. And these fellas did an awful lot of good for me. After the power of example, they taught me a good many things. simple things, but truth. I remember they didn't suggest anything to me. These fellas told me. They told me. They gave me rules. They gave me some things that I'd have to do, and I was expected to do. And I wanted more than anything else to really belong to that gang. I wanted a sense of belonging. I didn't think I belonged to anything or anyone at the time, and I guess I didn't. And these fellas, I wanted to be a part of them, a part of their fellowship. And I had a very strong urge in those days. I felt that I never really would ever be a member, a real member of this fellowship, until I had sponsored someone. And believe me, I was alone in Cleveland, and I went to my meetings down in Akron, Ohio. And I'd get back there in Cleveland, and I became the first and foremost barstool snatcher in history. And I might say the most unsuccessful one. And I just went every place that there were rummies. And I would talk to them, I'd lie down with them, I'd climb up to them, any place they were, I was there. And I was trying to convince them they ought to be like me, but none of them wanted to be like me. I tried very hard. It took me a long, long time before I ever got my first baby in a hospital. I know how long it took. It's a long story of what happened, the story in itself. So I remember getting that first fellow in the hospital, and I tell you, I was walking 10 feet tall. But it was wonderful. I felt that I really belonged. This is how I valued this fellowship and valued the company of these other men. And I felt now I do belong to something. I had arrived someplace in my life. I finally had made life worthwhile and made myself worthwhile. This was a great experience. I remember things that people told me and things some of these fellows, how they helped me. Different ones. My sponsor, I would ask him a lot of questions. Generally, he would answer me by referring to some passage in Scripture. And I asked him about this. We see these cliches hanging around on our walls, like first things first, and you hear people talk about this. I can remember asking Doc about this. I said, what does all this first things first mean? So Doc looks at me a minute, he says, read your good book, it'll tell you. I said, where will I find it? Well, he says, you'll find this in there. He said, seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. This is where first things first came, according to my sponsor. I've never forgotten that. Our program was designed and it was taken from the Sermon on the Mount and the book of James. All the basis of our program you'll find in those two places, in the good book. Why I think it's so important that so many of us read this Sermon on the Mount over and over. And a good many people have the book by Emmett Fox. It's a very understandable little thing that we can read and gets to us. This is the basis for our program, and my sponsor used to answer me along these lines when I asked him questions. I think this did me a lot of good. One of the greatest things that ever happened to me, it's one of the greatest, was one time after a meeting, one of these fellas helped me, gave me something that I think was more responsible for changing my life than anything else. It was after a meeting down in Akron. This fellow, Bill Van Horn, all these fellows are dead now, so I can wreck their anonymity. They'd be probably glad to have it wrecked. And Bill was a great fellow. He was a big, rough, tough character, and Bill took a big shine to me for some reason or other. I don't know why. But he always was talking to me after meetings. He'd get me in a corner and talk to me at great length. And to tell you the truth, I was about half scared of this fellow. Bill had been in the Maslin State Insane Asylum, the Happy Farm there. His folks had put him away and they'd thrown the key away on him. And Doc got him out. And Bill never had another drink till the day he died. And Bill preceded me into this fellowship by about 6 months. One evening after a meeting, Bill got me aside, and I can still see him like it was yesterday. He says, "Clarence," he says, "I'm going to give you the answer to this whole thing, this whole ball of wax." He says, "I'm going to give you something here. I want you to read it. I want you to memorize it. I don't want you ever forget it. Because here's the answer to the whole deal." So Bill, I can still see him. He took out his billfold, big, thick old billfold full of all kinds of stuff. And he's taken all this debris out of it and putting it on a table. All kinds of papers and pictures and different things, everything but money. And finally, Bill found what he was looking for. And he handed me this slip of paper. And I looked at this slip of paper, and lo and behold, it's a Bible verse. I looked at that Bible verse, and I looked at that big gorilla in front of me. And I thought, well, maybe this guy came out a little too soon. But I did what Bill told me. I read this thing, and I did memorize it, and I did never forget it. And I think that it had a marked change on me in my life, because I think it is the answer to the whole thing. I found it so. It was a verse from the 2 Corinthians, the 5th chapter, the 17th verse. And it reads this way: "Therefore, if any man be in Christ, he is a new creature. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things are become new." Think about that. If any man be in Christ, he's a new creature. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things are become new. If any man be in Christ. This is exactly what happens to us. This is the change we're talking about. And this made a tremendous impression on me. Now, our program is a very simple program. And these people who preceded me helped me in understanding this. They weren't all alcoholics who helped me. T. Henry Williams, the man who was in charge of the Oxford movement down there, he was a great help to me. My sponsor was. Other people were. But by and large, I finally, after this program was designed, it was designed along this same line. A need for a change, an acceptance of this, and then living a life of service. This is what happens to us. Now, I'd like to quickly go over my interpretation of these steps, because this is how it works. This is what it says, how it works. Our program is, I believe, divided into four phases. The first phase is a phase of admittance. In the first step, we admitted we are powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable. I had no problem with that. The evidence was all about me. My life was unmanageable. Second phase of our program is the second through the seventh step. These are the steps of submission. Since I can't control my own life, I must submit my life and my will to the care of God, and I do so in the second through seventh step. Second step says we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I like that sanity deal there. That took me off the hook. I hate to think that the things I did when I was drunk, I did as a sane man. But when they told me I was nuts, this gave me great relief. So I had no quarrel with this. And I likewise think if we're not nuts, we don't belong here. There has to be something different about us than other people. And if you've been around any length of time and you haven't recognized the difference, there's something wrong with you. You're sicker than I was. Third step is a step which really separates the men from the boys. Here's where we start to get into AA. Unless we take this third step, we never get into this fellowship. We might be in a meeting. We might be on the periphery of this. We might enjoy some of the associations in AA, but we're never going to be in this program or on it. So we take step three. Because we made a decision, turn our will and our life over to the care of God. Now that's really asking something of rummy to do that. And no rummy's gonna do that unless he really hurts, unless he really means business and is ready to go all the way. So ask an alcoholic to turn his will and his life over to the care of this ethereal creature in the far blue yonder, whom he knows very little about and probably scared to death of. This is a real test. And this is where he has to make his decision. He does or he doesn't. If he doesn't, I don't say that he's going right out and get drunk today. But that quality of life I'm talking about is going to elude him. It's going to elude him. Eventually, he's going to have to come to this if he wants to be known as an AA. I'm not talking about BB or ZZ or double X. I'm talking about AA. Then we have to find out what we have to work with when we make this decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God. So he says next, we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. A searching and fearless moral inventory. Just get that. Do you think he's capable of doing that by himself? I don't think so. If he is, he's more of a genius than I was. And I don't think you are any more of a genius. I think you're all good. A gal coming in AA needs help on that fourth step. As you and I have conditioned ourselves over the years that we can find justification for anything we've ever done or anything we are about to do. And when we start taking a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves, that's just too big a bite for us to do by ourselves without some help. And I think that must be done with the help of our sponsor. The next step suggests there is someone there that did it, that has been there helping us, because it says we admit it to God, to ourselves, and to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. But suggests there has been someone there. There had to be another human being evidence. This is the way this program works. It's starting to work on us now. All right, after making this admittance, and all this, says we were entirely ready for what? We were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Now, how about that? I can't remove them, and there's some defects of character I would rather keep. And I don't think I'm unique in this. But the program doesn't say that I can do this. It don't give me any leeway on this deal. It's all or nothing at all. It says we're entirely ready to remove all these defects. Goodbye some of these things that I want to keep hang on to. No more reservations. Reservations are things that kill us. If we still think we can run our own show, that quality is going to be eluded. All right. Next step says we humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. We humbly asked him. We didn't make a deal. We just asked God to remove these shortcomings. All right, now we've had two phases of our program. We've had the phase of admittance, and we've submitted our will and our life to the care of God. Great. We've done something now. We have to do something further now. We're going into a new life because we have dispense with the old, and we've turned all this over to our God. He's going to do things for us. We still have to do something so we don't carry the garbage of the old life into the new. So we have our next phase, and this is a phase of restitution. This takes place in the eighth and ninth step. It says we made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Next step says we all. Except when to do so would injure them or others. Just like the fourth step, I think that restitution phase needs the help. We should have help from our sponsor. We can get a lot of great ideas and we can make all kinds of fine resolutions what we're going to do and run off half-cocked and follow up the whole detail right there. I think this restitution deal needs assistance from someone who is knowledgeable and experienced and understanding in this way of life. I've seen some pretty dreadful things happen to people who go out with all the enthusiasm and no sense and expose a lot of things that they have no business doing or doing it in the wrong way. Believe me, there's some of these things in restitution need some real handling. I can think of some that I've experienced with different people. I had a couple of very bad ones myself, but I think one of the worst I ever got into was a chap that came to me one time, and this was down here in Florida, too. I didn't think people were this bad in Florida. This guy had 5 wives, and he had families with every one but the last one, and he had never bothered or worried himself to go through the process of divorce. And all of these women were still alive, and so were all these kids running all over the country. Now, this guy had some restitution to take care of. And he wasn't the only one interested in this either. He came with a problem. He needed help. Now, what do you do with a guy like this? Obvious thing, most people say, well, turn him over. Save society. This guy's still out of jail. He never served a day. But it took some real handling, believe me. But these things need handling. We have a life to go into. We have a life to, and a lot of things to make up for. But we have to do this once. And then we live. Don't have to carry this stuff with us the rest of our life. There's ways of doing this thing. I've seen some tremendous things happen to people's lives, and so have you. You've seen tremendous things happen to everyone's life that sits in this room. Everyone comes in here is different than it used to be. Terrific changes. All right, this restitution, we do what we can in this wherever possible. Now, obviously, we can't make restitution to everyone. We don't know everyone we've harmed. And some of them aren't accessible. So we have to leave that in the hands of God, and we ask Him to take care of these things. We are clean then. We get clean, and we start off in this new life clean. So we have gone through 3 phases, admission, submission, and restitution. We have taken 9 steps. After we've taken 9 steps in this program, we are in a new life. Now we have to build the quality. We've taken these 9 steps. Listen to what I'm going to say now, because somebody else, again, he's writing a new program. I have been accused of a lot of things. Change in AA. I have never changed AA. There's been a lot of guys that have been changing a lot of things in AA. There's a lot of things come in AA since I've come in that I never heard of when I started out. Some of these are good. Some of them stink. But some of them are very good. And things have to change when we grow the way we've grown. 30 people. 30 people. I thought it would be great. The other day, some fellow from Cleveland sent me a reprint of the original old Plain Dealer articles that caused such a big stir. And this is what really got AA off the ground all over the country, these articles. And boy, I tell you, I think about in terms of 30 people one time. First thing, now they got 150 groups in that town. Probably more, I don't know. There's scores of them that I don't even know about now. This is quality. This is growth. A lot of people have benefited. And a lot of people are an awful lot different than they used to be. I was thinking about this crowd in here last night. This place was full last night. All these people. What a tremendous crowd we had here. We have over 600 people registered here. Just think, look at that crowd, look at these people here this morning. What do you think would happen if all of a sudden this whole bunch decided to get drunk all at one time? They'd move this hotel down to Miami. We are somewhat different than we were, and there's a different quality here. Now, After we have taken these 9 steps, here's what I want to say. Forget them. You never have to worry about these 9 steps anymore. You're done with them. You've done something. I said, make your decision once. You never have to do it again. We've done it. The only time we'll ever have to refer to these first 9 steps is when, in 2 instances in our life, this could be possible. It's when we're trying to explain it, like I'm trying to do now. We're trying to explain these steps to a new person, or we're sponsoring someone, or trying to explain them in a group meeting, such as we're doing now, or a discussion meeting. Or the other instance is, if we ever resign and resume, obviously we're going to have to do them all over again. But since we are going along, we've done these 9 steps, we don't have to mess with them anymore. They all have demanded some action on our part, and we have taken this action. Now our life has changed, and we're ready to build this quality of life. So the last phase of our program I call construction. Admission, submission, restitution, now construction. Here's where we construct our life. The 10th step, this is a terrific step. It has nothing whatever to do with step 4. Don't get them confused. Step 4 was necessary in our beginning. This step here in number 10 is our daily check on ourselves. In my experience with alcoholics over the 30 years that I've been sober in AA, I have learned a few things, believe me. And one thing that's very important that I've learned, and I learned this quite early in my experience, that it isn't big things that throw us. I've seen tremendous tragedies, very awful tragedies happen to people who are in AA. They didn't get drunk. But I've seen people come into AA and have a wonderful time. They've got a new job, a new wife, a new home, a new car, and they got jingle in a pocket, and they're making advancement, and bingo! They get drunk, and they get in all kinds of trouble. I've seen this. Not because they have in prosperity. Not at all. There's nothing wrong with prosperity. I think we all should have it. But it's a matter of our values, what happens here. And it's the little things that throw us, not the big things. A combination and a growth of a lot of little things. And this is why we have this 10th step, to take care of the little things that happen every day in our life. Every day, we meet up with all kinds of people. I'm a salesman myself, and I've often said that there ought to be an open season so salesmen could take advantage of this sometime. You're allowed to shoot people with impunity. But it's about true. We meet people all day long, and they're pretty trying, believe me. And sometimes we're tempted to do things that we have no business doing. And every day we have the... At one time we did not have to live. We existed. And if things got too rough, we jumped in that jug. And there was no problem. An alcoholic has no problem when he's drunk. He only has a problem when he's coming out of that drunk and starting to face life. This is when the problems come. When we were drunk, we had... What could worry us? We couldn't feel anything. We're unconscious. Where's the problem? No problem. We're anesthetized. But when we come out of this, that's when the problems come up. Now, if we're staying sober and trying to live a life of quality, we better take account of the little things that happen to us every day. These are the things that make us or break us. Very few big things ever do happen to any of us. At numerous little things every day. And this is the reason for the 10th step. It says we continue to take personal inventory. And when we were wrong, we promptly admitted it. Here's one of the toughest things for Rummy to do, admit he's wrong. We never admit anything. We won't even admit it's raining outside. It might involve us in something. But to admit that we're wrong, this is unheard of. No, sir. We'll battle and fight and try to justify ourselves in these things. But to take care of these little things every day, here's the way I do mine. I tell you, I keep a very simple program. It has to be for me, because I'm not too bright. But here's what I do, and my tenth step, every night this happens to me. Sometimes I don't get to sleep right away. But at night when I'm alone, I lie down in that bed at night and it's dark and I'm by myself. And we all can do this. It's very simple. This is my prayer time. And I think about my day. I go over my day. I think about what I've done today, who I've seen, what I've done, who I've talked to. Some days I'm not too proud of what I've done, really. I have apologies to make to someone. I don't waste any time doing that, believe me. On the other hand, some nights I find out that I've done some things today that I think are all right. I've done pretty good. I say, well, oh boy, you did all right on that time. I'll give you a gold star that time. You did all right today. But this isn't always the case. Sometimes it's not so good. But if I permit these small things to crowd me and grow and build up on me, eventually there's too many little things, and they become big things, and they grow. And I can't handle it anymore, and I'm in real trouble. This is you and I both. We have this. This is us. So that tenth step is so important to give us our daily check on ourselves. It's a tremendous step. We only have to worry about handling three steps the rest of our life. Remember this. This is very simple program. Our 11th step here is a tremendous step. I want to break this step down and show you what it means to me. The 11th step is a step which brings us into a prayer life. Listen to what this is. There's an awful lot of words in it. It says, we sought through prayer and meditation. We're seeking something through prayer and meditation. We sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. Praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. A lot of words, isn't it? Let's see what they mean. It says we're seeking something through prayer and meditation. We're seeking to establish a conscious contact with God. Well, that seems odd. We're doing this through prayer and meditation. Now, to people who know nothing about prayer and meditation, let's see what this is. I say prayer is talking to God. And meditation is listening to Him. Now, a good many of us do a lot of talking, but we never stop and listen. Here's where we fail. I notice in the human anatomy that the good Lord gave us two ears and one mouth. There must have been a reason for this. You listen to this buzz going around here last night out in that lobby. Everybody's talking, nobody's listening. I remember up at that Toronto deal, before you ever get into the lobby of that hotel, you can hear them down the street. Nobody listening, everybody talking. This is us. At night, we should do our talking and we should do our listening and we'll get answers. We have to get these answers because we have turned our will and our life over to the care of God, and we've asked Him to direct our lives. And how are we going to know unless we listen to Him? The good book says, and the good Lord says, be still, be still. And if we can only be still for a while, and this is in the privacy of our own little chamber, wherever we may be, this is a place we do this, just you, just me and God, that's all. This is important. So we sought through talking to Him and listening to Him. When I was in the old Oxford group, they never did anything. Those people never did anything except through guidance. Guidance. One of the things that mostly impressed me when I entered that group in the old days was the way they started their meetings there. Their meeting, their format was much different than our format here is today. They used to have a guidance meeting to choose the leader for the evening. They'd go down, a bunch of these people who were surrendered people, they'd go down, they'd go into a period of meditation. They'd all have pencil and paper, and they'd go in meditation, and they through this meditation, they would write down whatever came into their mind, answers to their prayer. And they were down there trying to find out who should lead the meeting. It's amazing to me how many, it always was a source of amazement, how many people had that same name on the paper. Terrific, see? So that's talking and that's listening. They couldn't have done this if they hadn't been listening. So we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. What's that mean? Well, I want to know that God is here and ever present, and He's closer, as a good book says, than hands and feet. He's closer than my friend here. I can reach over and touch Him. I can talk to Him, get response from Him. This is what we're trying to do. So we sought this through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. Now it tells us what we're praying for. We're praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. How about that? Do you see anything in this whole 12-step program that says that we should pray for sobriety? You people are getting up praying for sobriety. Forget it. You've got your sobriety. Thank God for it. You don't have to pray for it. That's all been done. Does it say one word in that program that says you shouldn't drink? This is a reformed drink movement or something. Does it say anything about that? It says anything about drinking. No, it doesn't do that, does it? It says something about that God is going to direct us, and we're going to find out from Him what He wants us to do. That's what He says. And He certainly doesn't want us to drink. No, sir. So we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, praying only for knowledge of His will for us. What do you want me to do, God? And the power to carry that out. The good book says that He'll never give us anything, put anything on us that He won't give us the power to handle. Right? That step tells us the same thing. We must believe that. Now the 12th step, this is the real crusher. This is the one that all you hear an awful lot about and a lot of activity about, and they talk about 12-stepping, and I'm going on the 12-step call and all this sort of jazz. What does the 12-step say? It starts right off and says that because we have taken these steps, something has happened to us. What has happened? It says, having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps. In other words, we had a change. We had a spiritual experience because we took these steps. A person who didn't take these steps, obviously, doesn't stand much chance of having this change, does he? That's what the program calls for. I'm talking about the AA program. I'm not talking about any other program that somebody else has written lately. I'm talking about the AA program. Having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, now listen what it says. Very carefully. We tried to carry this message of love and service, I should say. We tried to carry this message to other alcoholics. Eh? It doesn't say we're trying to carry this message to the man in the moon, or all the civilians, or all the doctors, or all the nurses, or all the psychiatrists, or all the what have you. It says we tried to carry this message to other alcoholics. And to practice these principles. What principles? The principles we've been talking about here of love and service. Practice these principles in all of our affairs, not just at our AA meeting. We have to do this in business. We have to do this at home. We have to do it with our neighbors. We have to do it with people we come into contact with. We have to do it with people we don't like. This is important. We talk about liking and loving. We have to love everyone. We don't have to like everybody. If some of these birds around here, I could break their back. And they probably feel likewise about me. But that isn't very loving and it isn't very liking. But I have to love them. If this fellow has a need, and I can help him with it, it's my privilege, my duty, my responsibility to do this. I spent a good much of my time in these last 30 years doing these things. I don't have any regrets for it. I know I've probably
neglected a lot of other things sometimes along the way, but I think they've paid me dividends, because what did I come here for in the first place? I came here because I was a drunken bum, and I wanted something different. And I got something different here. I had the opportunity, and these people helped me. The only one way I can help myself is dedicate myself to this, and I continue to do so. And I recommend the same thing for anyone else. This is the meaning of this program to me. This is a changed life. New life. No person can have a real quality of living, an alcoholic, without changing his life. I've seen people quit drinking through just ordinary cussedness. They've quit drinking. And they're the most miserable buggers I have ever met in my life. I like the people who come to AA and quit and stay quit the best they can, because they have a different spirit. They're different kind of people. You feel differently with them. When I came to this fellowship, I came into this fellowship in February of 1938. And I'll tell you right here now, I did not have one friend in the world. Not one. I didn't even have anyone in my family that would have anything to do with me. Today, I have thousands of friends. And I don't mean this just to say that there are thousands of alcoholics around. I know them personally, and they know me. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised if I could bum a quarter off every one of them if I wanted to. And these same thousands that I knew in the old days, I couldn't raise a quarter among the whole bunch. But these people are my friends. We have a different communication, a different feeling. There's no fellowship like this fellowship of AA. I belong to clubs and lodges and veterans groups and other organizations. And I've been all through this church work bit. But there is no fellowship anywhere the equal of this, or anything that's akin to this. We meet differently. We communicate differently. We live differently together. I get a big kick out of this every once in a while. I'll bet to any of these people here who do this. I see some fellas sitting around in here who are invited to go places, same as I am. I go all over the country on AA invitation to different conventions and retreats and things like this. And this happens to me, and I'll bet the ambitious happens to you 100 times too. I'll go way off to some far off place. I'll never forget. I think one of the weirdest place I ever got wound up in was Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan. Now, who ever heard of Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan? But I was invited to go up there one time to speak at an anniversary or a convention. And I don't know how many planes I had to take to get there, but you get up to finally to, after you leave, you get to Regina. That's the end of the line. After that, you take a dog sled. I mean, this is some place up there. It's great. They're AAs. They're wonderful people. But I remember getting off the plane up there on a Friday night, and all the peddlers are getting off. All the men are going home for the weekend. And this plane is full of people. Big crowd getting off. I don't know one person in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan. If someone's heard my tape or heard about me or something and sent for me to come up there, someone told them. So I don't know anyone there. They don't know me from a bale of hay. So I get off this plane, all these 100 other people getting off, all these men getting off the same time I am. A bunch of people in the airport. What happens? I walk up there, there's a bunch of guys. Immediately they see me, there he is. Bingo. How do they know me from 100 other guys? Huh? Places. And I bet you any of you fellas have had this experience. You have. Why do they know me? Why do they know you? Why does a panhandler walk down the street and he'll pass 9 people and hit you? Is it your smell? Some kind of a radar we have here. One rummy, I remember going into a lodge one time. I entered a lodge. One of the things they said in the ritual, different means of communication. so that one may know another in the dark as well as in the light. Boy, we got that. We don't need a handshake for it either. Believe me, this happens to us. We are a society all of our own. The Jews claim to be the chosen people. Don't you kid yourself, we are it. Of all the people in the world, the millions of people who've been alcoholics, just a few thousand of us have this opportunity. We are, of all people, the most blessed. I'm certainly glad I'm one of you. Thank you.